The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, November 8th, 2016. Don't forget to go out and vote.
And now, it all comes down to this. In towns and cities across the nation, the quiet voters say hello once again to their neighbors, to those nice folks at the precinct table who tell them which line to stand in. They wait, they make their choice, and they go on with their days.
This is by far the longest line I've ever seen for an election. It wraps all the way down the block.
Before sunrise, there were already about 150 people at my polling site.
There was a line when we got here, and it grew as we were waiting. In the 15 minutes, it looped around inside.
I have a lot of alcohol to prepare me for the end of this. God, it's been a rough year and a half, huh?
This is America. This is Election Day. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and this show was born about 8 years ago in another election campaign. We've had so much to talk about since then, so much to think about in this campaign, so much to fear, so much anticipation. The Barack Obama era ends today, and something new begins. Aaron Copland, I think, perfectly captures it in this familiar music from the score of Our Town. Campaigns are loud, this one particularly, but voting is a pause to reflect. It's quiet and unavoidable. The polls are open. America is about to exhale after a long campaign that tested democracy, freedom, tolerance. And this hour, we will range far and wide to observe and remind ourselves of the ritual that's at the center of our form of government. But first, we go to a place that's been discussed all throughout this campaign, the state of Pennsylvania. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is, where are you right now, Todd?
John, I'm in Kimberton, which is a town in Chester County, just west of Philadelphia, the swing county of Chester.
So we're leaving Philadelphia, leaving the Democratic strongholds, and heading into Republican territory.
Heading west. And what happens in Pennsylvania when you leave the turnout machine for Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania, and as you go west, it gets a little bit lighter blue, then it gets gray, and then it starts to turn pink. And here in Kimberton is a place within Chester County that starts to turn pink. Now, Chester County is the knife's edge of the swing situation here in Pennsylvania, because back in 2012, Mitt Romney won Chester County by just 1,000 votes out of 250,000 cast. So you can see how close it is here. There are some towns even in the eastern part of the county that are a lot more blue, a lot more pro-Hillary. And then as you move west, it starts to do what Pennsylvania does, which is get more and more red, and then it becomes deep red all the way until you get to downtown Pittsburgh. And that's sort of the dynamic here as Hillary Clinton tries to turn them out in downtown Philly and city of Philadelphia and then the ring suburbs around Philly. The more you go west, the harder it is for her. Donald Trump has the advantage, and he has to try to catch up with all that city turnout that she has.
What are the voting lines, the sentiments of the people at the polling stations? What do they suggest about the differences between Republicans and Democrats on this day?
Now, John, I'm standing right here, right outside this polling place at the Kimberton Fire Company. I've been talking to voters as they go in. Dave Wilson is retired. He's worked in auto salvage and the auto insurance industry. And he basically said it's about blue-collar workers in Pennsylvania and people wanting their jobs back.
Trump. You know, VFW, everyone's Trump. I think Trump's going to win it. I think there's more blue-collar people who needs more jobs than to be shut down like it's been for the last 8 years. I mean, a 1% growth in jobs in 8 years, that's nothing.
And that pragmatism is, I guess what Trump is all about, although economists doubt whether that's actually a practical reality.
And for a lot of voters that I've talked to, it's this mixture, right? For some people, it's the idea of change. Donald Trump is unconventional. He's different. He's off the cuff. He's not a politician. He's a businessman. And then, of course, it's for a lot of people, it's that he's not Hillary Clinton. I think it's safe to say in Kimberton, in this part of Chester County, there's a lot of people who would just count themselves as anti-Hillary. I talked to Heather Thompson. She didn't tell me who she's voting for, but she's a bartender here in town, and she says that most of her customers are pro-Trump, and she kind of talks about what it's like to be behind the bar.
A lot of excitement for Trump. Yeah. I don't know. It's the craziest election I've ever seen. It's bringing a lot more emotion than most of them, and makes me a little nervous for my kids. So you don't want to talk about politics and religion with your customers. You don't want to piss anybody off.
Or mess up your tips.
No. You must have been a bartender at one time.
Any suggestion from the turnout and the people you're talking to about how the Senate race is going?
Well, that's key, right? Because you have the battle of who's going to take over the Senate. Democrats need 4 seats if Hillary wins, 5 if she loses, to take over control. And this race here in Pennsylvania is pivotal. The incumbent, Pat Toomey, and the Democratic challenger, Katie McGinty, she appears to have the narrowest edge going into today. Maybe a point, maybe a point and a half. It's hard to tell. But Pat Toomey has been one of these Republican senators who has really been threading the needle. There are a lot of Trump supporters in Pennsylvania, it's true. But Pat Toomey is running in a swing state, and he needs some Democratic votes to win here. Don't forget, Pennsylvania has about 600,000 more registered Democrats than it does Republicans. How has Pat Toomey dealt with this? Hey, he hasn't said who he's voting for this entire election. He's refused to endorse Donald Trump. He said a couple of good things about him, but he hasn't even told the voters if he's voting for Donald Trump. And Pat Toomey just told some reporters today in Pennsylvania that he's going to vote at 6:45 tonight, John, and he's not tipping his hand about who he's voting for. And that just tells you what kind of state Pennsylvania is and what kind of challenges the Donald Trump candidacy has brought to establishment Republicans like Pat Toomey, who's trying to hang on to his seat and trying to help Republicans maintain control.
It also reminds us that this election, more than probably any other in my living memory, is about that experience when you get in the voting booth, the epiphany when you're looking at that ballot. Any sense that people are having that?
Oh, John, I was just standing right outside the polling place here, and I just want to play you part of a conversation I had with a woman named Rachel Bright. She absolutely poured out of the doors to the polling place. She was laughing and sobbing. She had her 3 kids in tow, and I ran up to her, and I said, "What's going on?"
I just voted for, hopefully, the first woman president, and I just could not be happier. I mean, my grandma, who died in 1997, she was born 5 years before women got the right to vote. And I just, you know, she was here. She was here with me in this moment. It's just so thrilling to be here and to just vote for hope and love. And to vote for things and not simply for, you know, against something. It's just a very good moment right now. So, I can't believe I just screamed when I came out there. I probably just scared all my neighbors.
And you might see a lot of smiles tonight, right?
Well, we don't know. Win or lose, I'm going to be at a couple of watch parties tonight in Easton, Pennsylvania, north of here, to get the reaction from the hardcore Trump people about their future, whether he's going to be the next president or what they're going to do if they realize that Hillary Clinton is the next president. That'll be in Easton, north of here, John. I can't wait.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent in the Keystone State. Social media has been an opportunity for candidates, but it's also created a unique opportunity for a coalition of journalists and data watchers from ProPublica, WNYC News, and Google, among others. Together, they have assembled a pop-up newsroom at the City University of New York CUNY Graduate School of Journalism in New York City called Election Land. They're watching for potential problems at polling sites across the country. WNYC's senior editor for Data News, John Keefe, joins us. What are you seeing through that window right now?
We're seeing a lot of long lines at the polls. This started when polls opened on the East Coast, and it is definitely continuing across the country. We're tracking all sorts of voting problems, right? From long lines to broken machines, missing ballots, other things, missing affidavit ballots. things like that. And it's definitely an issue in many, many communities. We had poll books, the books with your names in it, were in the wrong places in many sites in New York City. And sort of across the board, we're seeing this. That said, it's kind of typical for what happens on election day. We're happy that we can see that and then actually report it out. Our whole goal is to get stories broadcast and published in real time while there's still time to fix those problems. And election officials clearly are jumping on the case, but that doesn't mean people aren't waiting. There are a lot of people waiting in line.
And the tolerance for these waits, given the interest in this election, is probably pretty high.
It might be high, but there is also the issue that researchers have studied that if you have to wait in line for more than 30 minutes, you start to be more likely to walk away. And if that's going to be 1 or 2 hours, that goes up. And for some people, it's not an option. They have to get to work. They have to do other things, get their kids. So that's definitely something that we think is worth reporting out and tracking.
Does the ability to monitor in real time ameliorate some of the, you know, disparities from one community to the other, the fact that this is a state-controlled operation and that you're going to see variance? Or does your gut tell you, man, we need a federal standard operation here?
Well, I don't know about the federal standard, but there is definitely differences in laws across the country. This is the first presidential election since 1965 without the protections of the Voting Rights Act. So there's a Supreme Court decision in 2013 that struck down parts of that, and at least a dozen states actually changed their laws. There's actually right now confusion about the voter ID requirements in Texas. There were rulings only in the last few weeks that changed the rules. So it is a really interesting problem. Whether or not this becomes like across the board federally, I actually frankly suspect it won't. We have some benefits of that, actually. It's because of the bespoke nature at every individual local level. It's actually harder to do things like hack an entire country's election system, which is a benefit. But it does mean that there's a patchwork of different rules in different places. And so you really have to know what is true in your locality about voting and what requirements there are.
One consequence of the rhetoric of this election is that too much vigilance on the part of citizens might not be a good thing. What have you noticed, and what interventions are you looking to possibly do if people get a little too close to the process, try to help too much, that sort of thing?
Well, we haven't seen any organized, like widespread or seriously organized effort to monitor the polls. There was definitely conversation about that going on before today's election. We have not seen that yet. It's early in the day here yet. So we're keeping an eye on that. We are inviting people to participate by just reporting their own experiences. We're inviting people to do that by texting the word electionland to 69866.
John Keefe, WNYC's senior editor for Data News, part of a coalition of data watchers and journalists from ProPublica, WNYC News, and Google. John, good luck. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by American Express. American Express has cards and services designed for businesses of all sizes. Learn more at open.com.
So what if a city could sue real estate developers and banks for, say, practices they believe made it so segregated that pockets of poverty and flight of affluent residents hurt the city's property values and tax base? Well, that's the disruptive proposition the Supreme Court will hear today in a case that narrowly questions the scope of the Fair Housing Act. The city of Miami alleges that banks, Wells Fargo and Bank of America, have violated the FHA by offering predatory loans to African Americans and Latinos. The consequences of those bad loans have been run-down neighborhoods, increased crime, and increased costs for law enforcement. Amy Howe, a reporter for SCOTUS blog, says a ruling for the banks means it may be harder to fight discrimination. A ruling for the city means banks may choose to opt out of the market altogether for lower-income borrowers.
what it boils down to is the city of Miami what Congress had in mind when it enacted the Fair Housing Act? Or is it really intended to be more specific to protect people and groups, you know, so civil rights groups or tenant groups that have been the actual victims of discrimination?
So the plaintiffs want the court to look at the consequences of predatory lending in Miami the same way it would look at, say, toxic, you know, contamination of water in Flint, that essentially you were responsible for the water. It was degraded and our citizens, as a result, suffered. We want damages.
Yes. And so the question before the court, is that what Congress had in mind when it enacted the Fair Housing Act? The city is saying, in effect, we were harmed by this discrimination, even if we weren't the direct victims.
Now, it's certainly the case that in the debate back in the days of the old Fair Housing Act, protecting the cities was something that Democrats particularly, and Republicans to a certain extent, wanted to accomplish. But will that be the evidence that is called upon to actually figure out what the intent was?
That's certainly part of the city's argument, is that the Fair Housing Act is really all about the effect that discrimination had on cities. And it's only natural that cities would be able to bring lawsuits under the Fair Housing Act. And in fact, I think the cities would say they are perhaps best suited to bring a lawsuit under the Fair Housing Act to try to get some compensation for this discriminatory lending, because in many cases, people may not know that they've been the victims of discriminatory lending. People may just know that they got a loan and the bank foreclosed and now they lost their houses. And so the city's argument is that, yes, the Fair Housing Act was all about cities, and this is exactly the kind of lawsuit that Congress had in mind.
In the case here, the plaintiffs are alleging that the predatory lending created foreclosures, which then degraded property values, et cetera. There are more details, but I'm just sort of sketching over them. Is this a case which could change segregation in housing in urban America, or is this much more narrow than that?
It's hard to say, because so much depends on exactly what the Supreme Court rules and how it says that. I mean, I think that the city's argument would be that we need to have this as sort of a tool in our arsenal to combat discrimination. Certainly individuals who've been the victim of discrimination should be able to sue, but cities should also be able to sue. I think that the bank's counterargument is that if we face liability, you know, on this scale, we don't think we did anything wrong, but even if we did, if we face liability on this scale, the answer is not going to be that we're going to make different loans. The answer is probably going to be that we aren't going to make many of these loans at all, because the risk is just too high and we might make far fewer loans to lower income borrowers. And that certainly isn't what the city would be seeking.
In this particular case, does an 8-justice court matter here?
I think it absolutely matters. Certainly, I think that we can expect that 3 of the court's more conservative justices, the Chief Justice John Roberts, Samuel Alito, and Clarence Thomas, to be supportive of the banks. I think, you know, we can probably expect the court's 4 more liberal justices to be supportive of the city. And then that leaves us, as in so many high-profile cases, with Justice Anthony Kennedy, who joined the court's 4 more liberal justices recently in another case involving the Fair Housing Act. But whether this is the sort of thing that is going to grab Justice Kennedy's attention to avoid having a 4-4 deadlock, whether, you know, he and perhaps Justice Stephen Breyer could come up with some sort of narrow compromise ruling. But I think it's absolutely a case in which the 8-justice court is very much at the forefront of everyone's minds.
This is a much larger discussion, but are we already seeing hints of real worries about the future of the court, given it being, you know, only 8 justices, not 9, and that the longer this goes on, the more trouble this is going to mean for the court's credibility?
I don't know that there's a sense necessarily that the court's credibility has been compromised. I do think there's a sense that despite the assertions by some justices that they're able to get work done, it's certainly true that many of the Supreme Court's cases are decided unanimously or, you know, with nine justices by a vote of 8-1 or 7-2, but it tends to be the cases that we're all the most interested in, which the court tends to be closely divided. And there is a sense that they are sort of operating with one hand tied behind their back, so to speak, on these high-profile cases because they only have eight justices.
Well, a very interesting case on the Fair Housing Act. Amy Howe, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Great to talk to you.
Amy Howe is a reporter for SCOTUS Blog. She spoke with us from Washington, D.C. We have a winner in famous Dixville Notch, New Hampshire, anyway. The Midnight Voters rang in Election Day with their every four-year celebration of voting, late-night eating, and a bit of Groundhog Day-style tradition. Eight residents in this sliver of America near the Canadian border. It's home to just eight people. Every Dixville Notch resident has shown up to vote since the inception of the Midnight Vote in 1960. Tom Tillotson is the town moderator of Dixville Notch. Tom, and the winner is...
Hillary took Dixville. Four votes, to two for Trump and one for Johnson and one write-in for Mitt Romney.
Now, do you know the fellow who did the write-in for Mitt Romney?
I know the person, yes.
Yeah. And he's making a statement here, it sounds like.
Yes. they specifically told me that they just couldn't vote for anybody that's on the ticket, on any of the tickets. So they voted their conscience and put in who they voted for the last time, I guess. This election is history. I mean, this election will go down as one of the most different elections that we've ever had. So it certainly didn't surprise me that somebody wrote in a choice. I'm actually a little surprised that more people didn't write in. But at the end of the day, I guess most of all except that one voter decided to make a choice between the candidates that were presented.
So you said this is the most different election in your recollection, and you've been doing this for 44 years. Is that an embarrassment to the world, as some have said? Is it a sign of a healthy democracy? Is it a real choice for Americans? End of the two-party system? What's your commentary?
In a way, I think it shows the health of our system. A lot of the things that are different about this election are new. The impact of social media, that's new. The way that the Trump candidacy evolved, that's kind of new, or at least new in our generation. There are a lot of voters, at least probably half of the ones here in Dixville, as well as maybe the rest of the country, that feel that somehow the process has evolved to a point where they're disappointed with it. I probably would count myself into that category. I think this election, more than any of the elections that I've been a part of for the last 44 years, is going to spark a debate that post-election as to what happened and how the maybe selection process or party process needs to change or evolve going forward to 2018 and 2020. But that's what our process does. Our system is an evolving process based on what our founding fathers, they had a vision that didn't include Twitter, it didn't include internet, it didn't include all the things that are going on, so many things that are going on today, and the fact that we still have a system that's evolving based on the founding fathers' ideas and modern developments. That's pretty amazing.
Final question. You all vote at midnight. I don't know where folks work in Dixville Notch, but do most people sleep in? Do they take the day off, or does everybody have to get in bright and early into the office?
I suspect most people are up by now and getting ready for their day.
Well, have a good day, Tom.
Thank you.
Tom Tillotson, Dixville Notch town moderator, where Hillary Clinton won a decisive victory at midnight.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Since 1980, the U.S. territory of Guam has held a straw poll on every election day. And for 32 years, that poll has accurately predicted the next president. Tom Maxidon is news director at Public Radio Guam. The polls are closed in Guam. Do you know the result yet?
We do have a winner. In fact, with 100% of the vote counted, all 67 precincts on Guam, Hillary Rodham Clinton has defeated Donald Trump in the presidential straw poll well over 3-1. It was 22,972 votes for Hillary Clinton and 7,747 votes for Donald Trump.
Now, what about the uniqueness of Guam might disqualify this result as a predictor? And then we'll talk about why it might be a good predictor.
Well, you know, the presidential straw poll has been correct since 1984 in determining the presidential outcome. Of course, we remember the election of 2000. Guam ultimately predicted George W. Bush, even though Al Gore won the popular vote. So I suppose if there were some kind of scenario like that on the mainland, that would possibly potentially throw out this vote. However, I think if you look at the record since 1984, as Guam goes, so goes the nation.
And there's a large contingent of military on Guam, and so you would expect a certain focus on national security. And so this overwhelming vote for Hillary Clinton suggests that some of the trends we've seen on the mainland are playing out.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, I talked to one voter today that was very key to her. She serves in the Guard, and she said, you know, if we're going to have a president who's going to ask us to go to war, per se, we'd like somebody in the White House that is stable. And she told me she just did not feel that Donald Trump was a stable individual. And it terrified her to have his finger on the button, as it were. That's a direct quote.
Now, I don't want to psychoanalyze Guam or anything, but a 3-1 vote for Hillary Clinton suggests, you know, before anyone votes on the mainland, that Guam is saying, hey, folks, no nonsense. Come on.
That could be one takeaway from that number. I honestly am surprised by the number. Our own informal exit polling, this was earlier in the day before the polls closed, was about 2-1 in favor of Hillary Rodham Clinton. So I was personally a little bit surprised by that number. Although the Democratic Party is very strong here on Guam, the GOP has made a lot of gains.
Why do Guam voters participate in this straw poll, knowing that it's not a part of the electoral contest?
I think that's just it. I think it's to send a message to Congress. We do not have a voting member of Congress. We do have a delegate to the United States Congress, but not a voting member to Congress. And so you have United States citizens here on Guam who can vote in their local elections, but cannot vote nationally. And that's a very bitter pill to swallow for residents here. Now, those folks who are in the military, who are still registered in their home districts on the mainland, can send in absentee ballots. But if you're a citizen living on Guam, registered to vote on Guam, you cannot vote on the mainland. So I think it's just a way of saying, hey, we might be a small, tiny island in the Western Pacific, but we deserve equal representation with the rest of the nation. And of course, we're not alone. The other three territories face the same consequences.
In local elections, how does the party fare? How do the parties fare in gubernatorial and legislative races?
Well, it's been kind of interesting the last several years out here. We've had 12 solid years of a GOP candidate in the governor's chair. And the legislature for the last several years has been overwhelmingly Democratic. 10-5 was the split for our legislature, 10 Democrats, 5 Republicans, but 5 total new faces. And I think what's contributing to that is actually a lot of younger voters who were very energized to get out the vote this time around. And that resulted in some of those new faces. The number one takeaway that I got from talking to people was that they simply wanted change.
Well, Tom Maxidon, have a nice sunset there on Guam.
John, you do the same. Thanks.
A few hours away for us. Tom Maxidon is news director at Public Radio Guam. Twitter is certainly something that came of age in this election. Can we even imagine the candidacy of Donald Trump without Twitter? This week, Twitter announced that there have been approximately a billion tweets about the election since last August. And that qualifies, I think, Twitter as a national treasure. I can imagine Ben Franklin himself twittering away. But as a company, Twitter is laying people off, facing skeptical shareholders and skeptical deep-pocketed buyers. Nathan Schneider says Twitter is a mode of communication that needs to be protected from market forces. Schneider is a journalist and professor at the University of Colorado. He co-edited the recently released book, Ours to Hack and to Own. Users should own Twitter, he says, like public media, or as he calls it, platform cooperativism.
You know, there's a word for that, and that's utility. You know, it's a service that we rely on that is kind of something that should be all of ours in some respect. And this really, I think, came to the fore for a lot of people as I started seeing the news coming out that Twitter was going to be sold to one company or another. And it started presenting itself as a kind of spectator sport. Who would buy this company that so many of us depend on? Wall Street considers it a failure. And I think a lot of people sat back and said, wait a second, Wall Street thinks Twitter's a failure? I use it all the time. It's really important for what I do. I don't think it's a failure at all. And maybe if those people were the ones that Twitter were ultimately accountable to, it would be able to create a healthier, more sustainable business model than the one that Wall Street and the companies currently kind of scavenging around it might be able to offer in turn.
In the old days, the public, the government in this case, would recognize the value of the utility you describe and immediately see that, in fact, it needs to be recognized as a common carrier, which is what happened to the railroads, which is what happened to the phone company. Why can't we do that now, or why don't we do that now?
Well, I think we're in a moment where political forces are just starting to recognize the role that online platforms are playing. We're starting to see some people in Washington talking this way. Elizabeth Warren has been talking, for instance, about the need to revive antitrust law that was developed around that age of the railroads for online platforms. Another precedent, though, that I think is really interesting is in 1936, when the federal government approved massive funding and support for rural electric cooperatives, when investor-owned companies weren't going into the rural areas to power them. The government set up low-cost loans that enabled electric co-ops to form all over the country. And these are organizations that are still powering 75% of the land mass of the United States today, and they're accountable to the people who depend on them. And they actually require less government regulation as a result. We can also look to examples like the Green Bay Packers, a football team that starting in 1923 started selling shares to its fans and as a result has fair ticket prices compared to the rest of the league, has remained loyal to a relatively small city rather than packing up and moving elsewhere for higher profits. And it's amazing if you look at a picture of the stadium, you see shockingly few ads. You know, you see an entirely different business model at work there.
What do you make of what CEO Jack Dorsey has said, the Twitter CEO? You know, if you listen between the lines, it seems like he's very much sympathetic with what you're saying. He doesn't like to be drawn into this, when are you going to go public and get your billions, pal, which is what he's always asked on all these financial news shows. But would he be willing to make Twitter the case study in the common carrier in the internet age?
Well, I can't speak for him, of course, but I think it is worth recognizing that, first of all, there are precedents for this. You know, companies in the past of various scales have sold shares to employees and employee stock ownership plans. There are cases where companies have outright cooperativized, and sometimes that can result in some handsome rewards for the founders to recognize their contributions and so forth. So this doesn't mean sending him to the poorhouse. But, you know, he's talked about Twitter as a public a public resource, the people's network. And they've made a lot of important choices to ensure that it really feels like a neutral platform.
Nathan Schneider, thanks so much.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
Nathan Schneider is a journalist and professor at the University of Colorado. He co-edited the book, Ours to Hack and to Own. In the annals of politics, campaign songs and little jingles get tossed out with the unused lawn signs after an election. But there are songs about voting that have met the test of time. With me now is host of WNYC's Soundcheck and New Sounds, John Schaefer. Hey, John.
Hi, John.
Are these songs that you've picked, are they campaign songs? Are they songs for election night? What do you think?
They are songs that are more meta than that. They're about the process. They're about being elected. What kind of person puts themselves in the position of a Donald Trump or a Hillary Clinton to put yourself out there? The size of the ego, it's not just about being elected. You want more than that. And for me, the classic song that gets to the nut of the matter is the song Elected by Alice Cooper.
Love that. And, you know, for me, since this song came out, it was always Nixon's face in my brain, but now it's Trump's face.
Well, you know, because I want to be elected, respected, selected, you know, it's self-affirmation, but the affirmation of others, of the crowd.
Okay, what else you got?
Cass McCombs is a contemporary singer-songwriter. What I like about his songs in general is they have a kind of rye, vinegary quality to them. And his take on the election process comes out in a song that he calls Don't Vote. Your uncle had an old saying,
if you don't vote, then you can't complain. Is that the Gen X wine or the millennial wine?
That is neither. It sets itself up as a wine. You know, the old canard, if you don't vote, you can't complain. John, I don't want to give people the impression that this is a kind of a recent development, because you can look back to the mid-20th century. The great jazz trombonist Jack Teagarden, for example.
Love him.
I Swung the Election is the name of this song.
I swung the election, friends. That's no small order. Just blow notes, sweep all the votes from Canada to the Mexican border.
That's crazy.
You caught the reference to the Mexican border? So this idea goes back a long way. And, you know, you can see that a lot of these musicians are kind of having some fun with the idea.
But 60s activism produced an enormous amount of music to go along with it. It really presages the hip-hop era, but it was much more, it seems, preachy and didactic.
Yeah, and that's where this James Brown song comes in. If anybody could make preachy and didactic funky and danceable, it's old JB. He actually did a couple of election songs, but this one, you know, so this is a little more serious than some of the other songs that we've been talking about. Get up, get into it, get involved is exactly what the title implies. It is a call to action. Everybody over there, get on up, everybody.
Don't stop that.
You can hear him calling back to his hit song, Sex Machine.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
Get on up.
Of course.
But in this case, it's get on up to do something else, something that's also very important, and that is to get involved in the process. So that's James Brown in a kind of serious mode. And to kind of stay in a serious mode for a moment, the old Delta Blues guitarist Sonnyland Slim, in his piece called Be Careful How You Vote, actually, the warning here is be careful how you vote, because the person you elect may turn around and do something completely opposite of what you voted for. Be careful how you vote, y'all, on every election day. Cause not one is too bumper. You know, to bring it all back to contemporary, you know, to 2016, there is a brand new song, came out last week.
Oh, really? Great.
By Jim James, the guy who fronts the band My Morning Jacket. It's called Same Old Lie. And cheated at, you best believe it's the silent majority. If you don't vote, it's on you. There is sort of a weird mixed message there. It's the same old lie, but then also that line about the old, if you don't vote, you can't complain.
Right.
Recognizing all of the many problems, at the end of the day, it's still the right thing to do, to go out and be a part of the process.
John Schaefer, host of WNYC's Soundcheck and New Sounds. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
One more thing. We couldn't wish you a happy election day without giving you some of the voices that are now on their way to the National Archives. Here's one more chance to look back at the last 2 years of the 2016 election.
Let's start at the very beginning.
I am officially running for President of the United States.
I am announcing that I'm running for President of the United States.
Who are you? I'm Ben Carson.
I announce my candidacy for President of the United States.
We cannot elect somebody that doesn't know how to do the job.
Donald Trump is a jerk.
And you know what they say about men with small hands?
I guarantee you there's no problem. I guarantee.
We won with poorly educated. I love the poorly educated.
But he's a chaos candidate, and he'd be a chaos president.
This election is about ending the grotesque level of income inequality in America.
Now, my opponent and I share many of the same goals, but some of his ideas for how to get there won't pass. Others just won't work.
I question a judgment which voted for the war in Iraq.
Talk about judgment and talk about the kinds of problems he had answering questions.
You gotta release the transcripts. Let everybody see.
The numbers don't add up.
We're gonna fight all the way to the Philadelphia Convention, and we're gonna win as many delegates as we can.
Hillary and I have a plan.
Look, Donald Trump and I have a plan.
There's two plans on the table. You got to pick your choice.
I honestly, Senator, you can roll out the numbers. You whipped out that Mexican thing again.
I can't imagine how you could defend that.
Friends.
My friends, it is with humility, determination.
I humbly and gratefully accept.
I accept
your
nomination
for the presidency of the United States. I alone can fix it.
Don't believe anyone who says, I alone can fix it.
We are going to build a great border wall.
We will not build a wall.
I am the law and order candidate.
If fighting for affordable child care and paid family leave is playing the woman card, then deal me in.
God bless you.
I want to take this opportunity to announce my candidacy for president, the Libertarian nomination for president in 2016.
I am here to announce that I am running for president of the United States.
And what is Aleppo? You're kidding. No.
But where has this strategy of voting for the lesser evil taken us?
So a man who can be provoked by a tweet should not have his fingers anywhere near the nuclear codes.
She has tremendous hate in her heart.
You could put half of Trump supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
Barack Obama was born in the United States, period.
He called this woman Miss Piggy.
Because you'd be in jail.
Donald thinks that climate change is a hoax.
I'll keep you in suspense.
He didn't pay any federal income tax.
And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab him by the...
I have now seen Director Comey's letter to Congress. It's pretty clear...
You're the pop. We will make America great again.
Let's make history together. Thank you and God bless you.
Go vote now. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks for listening. This is The Takeaway.
Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.